From KLCC Studios, this is Oregon on the Record.
I'm Michael Dunn. In the KLCC newsroom, and most likely in every newsroom, the most important thing are the journalists, and the second most important thing is the coffee machine. Indeed, coffee is the fuel for most people and most professions here in Oregon and around the world. Today on the show, we're going to dive into the chemical and societal importance of coffee and caffeine with a U of O professor affectionately known as Dr. Coffee. We'll explore how caffeine works in the brain and how coffee has done so much more for our society than just jolt us awake in the morning. That's next on Oregon on the Record. Perhaps you're like me and never think that much about your morning cup of coffee, except to think about how much you need it right after the alarm goes off. Well, today on the show, you'll meet and hear from a U of O professor who's dedicated his life to the study of coffee and the search for the perfect cup. Christopher Hendon, associate professor within the Department of Chemistry and Biochemistry at the U of O. Professor, thanks so much for coming on and talking with us.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, you know, you're known in some circles as Dr. Coffee. I wanted to start out by asking you, why did you want to, I know you study other things, but why did you want to study the chemistry and biochemistry of coffee?
Well, I don't know if I chose it or it chose me, but basically as a graduate student, I was drinking coffee as often as everybody else does when they're in grad school. And you know, I have other interests outside of chemistry, and coffee happened to be one of them. And I thought it would be interesting to merge my love of chemistry and my love of coffee. And so, you know, initially it started as a weekend activity, but it's now become more of a professional hobby.
So, Professor, how does coffee and its active ingredient, caffeine, work for us, work in our brain?
Right. Well, I'm not a biochemist, but rather a chemist. But I can speak to the composition of coffee and which molecules act on our body.
Okay.
So basically, most of us are drinking coffee first and foremost as you get up in the morning, gets you out of bed, wakes you up. And there are two reasons it does that. On one hand, coffee contains caffeine. Caffeine interacts with your brain and allows you to access energy storage that basically gives you that jolt that gets you going in the morning. But on the other hand, something that shouldn't be overlooked is that most people consume caffeine or coffee with milk and sugar and all these other sources of carbohydrates, which also then provide that additional source of energy. So it's not, when we're talking about coffee, my lab specifically studied black coffee, but it's worth remembering many people engage with coffee in the milk format. Okay. So you get those two different sources of energy. They're somewhat competing because one is caffeine is accessing energy you've already got inside your body, and the milk is providing new energy.
Okay. Many people, probably myself included, would say something like, I'm addicted to coffee. I'm addicted to caffeine. I really need it. And I'm wondering, you know, from your perspective as someone who studies it, is coffee and caffeine, is it a positive addiction for us?
I think by definition, addictions are never positive.
Okay.
But with everything that you ingest, there's a limit to which it's good for you until it becomes bad for you, you know? And coffee is just happens to be one of these foods that we drink or consume a lot. And so as a result, there's many people who have many, many cups of this per day. Whether or not there's a positive health benefit from doing so is to be seen. I mean, in the scientific literature, every year it seems like there's an article that says coffee's good for you. Then the next year it's bad for you. And the next year it's good for you, and so on. And when you look at the data that's supporting these claims, it's typically looking at one compound that shows up in high concentration in some coffee preparations. And then the next one will have a different compound that we focus on. But the point of all this is that what you're drinking is an ensemble of a variety of compounds. And yes, some of them are going to have only positive impact on your body. Some are going to have only negative. But it's about the concentration in which we're consuming them. And as a result, coffee is all relatively dilute families of molecules. And so while you may be addicted to caffeine or feel like you need to have it, otherwise you get headaches or whatever, coffee itself, broadly defined, it's neither good for you nor bad for you. It's just something that we like to drink, and it happens to have caffeine.
Okay. Certainly when you talk about other drugs and that sort of catch-all phrase of addiction, one of the things that I've always heard is that one of the really deleterious effects of addiction is you keep needing more. Now, again, very unscientifically, but I'll use myself as an example. I drink about 5 cups of coffee a day, and I've drank that same amount for decades. And so I'm wondering, is there a bit of a self-regulation built into coffee and caffeine that perhaps other quote-unquote stronger drugs don't have?
Yeah, I mean, what does needing more mean? I mean, you and I can exist without drinking coffee. It will be a sad existence, but tomorrow,
indeed,
you and I would survive.
Yeah.
We'd find a way. I think with these other stronger drugs, and even less strong drugs, perhaps ethanol is an example, it's not necessarily true that if you were to quit cold turkey that you would just survive. You know, so the addiction to caffeine is one where I think the addiction perhaps is less severe and the impact of quitting it is less severe. Having said that, it is definitely true that people feel worse if they rely on a cup of coffee in the morning and don't have it. I'm not sure that exists forever, but there's a, like, you know, if we skip coffee for a week, do we wean ourselves off of it? I don't know, because I've done the experiment before, and you know what I want after a week of no coffee is a cup of coffee, but not because I'm addicted to it, but simply because I like the taste of coffee.
Well, and that gets me to another question, which is, you know, like, I think the first time as a young kid I ever tried coffee, I thought, oh my God, why would anybody drink this terribly bitter, awful drink?
Yeah.
And I'm wondering, you know, like you just said, the taste of coffee, I think that may be the very definition of an acquired taste as we get older. And so my question to you is it because of the caffeine that gets us to like coffee as a taste? Or is there something else going on there? Is there something about coffee, even without the caffeine, that our body or our taste buds seem to crave?
Well, the domain of coffee I work in, specialty coffee is what it's called.
Mm-hmm.
Those types of coffees don't have that common flavor of coffee that I think you and I are probably imagining as you just introduced the question.
Yeah.
That sort of like that deep, rich bitterness, sort of baker's chocolate type flavor profile.
Mm-hmm.
Not all coffees have that flavor profile. And it's certainly true that if you give a child a very bitter, extremely dark roasted coffee that features skunky, rubbery, dark chocolate flavor notes, it wouldn't be surprising that the child may have an aversion to it because the perceived sweetness is low. The perceived acidity is low, the bitterness is high.
Mm-hmm.
On the other hand, there are many, many coffees that have extremely low bitterness, very high fruity acidity that tastes very sweet. Now, these coffees are typically lighter roasts, and it's not better or worse than a dark roast. In fact, I think that a well-roasted high-end coffee that is dark can be delightful. It's not that. It's just simply that flavor that we see so often in commodity coffee in most of the commercial cafes is a dark roast, low quality coffee that has these supremely bitter flavors. It's unsurprising then that the first time you ever have it, you may have an aversion to it. But adults train themselves to eat things that are perhaps maybe not that palatable the first time. Regularly. This is something that we do often. I mean, you can imagine, remember the very first sip of beer that you've had or whatever.
Sure.
Right? It's no different to that. I will say, though, the specialty coffees, if they were more ubiquitous and we were to expose a child to one of these high-end washed Ethiopian coffees that I love that tastes like a bouquet of flowers, I think we'd still have the child have an aversion to it on, you know, pretty regularly, but I think there'd be fewer. I think there'd be more people enjoying it early on because they wouldn't have experienced the supreme bitterness that, you know, that you see in some of these commodity coffees.
Interesting. That begs my next question. You know, we as Americans in sort of the general population, are we perhaps drinking the wrong coffee? You just described that Ethiopian blend that you love so much. And I know that we're in a bit of a golden age of coffee, and there probably are more flavors than have ever been available. But I'm just wondering, are a lot of us missing out on some incredible blends that we could get if we just knew where to look?
Yeah, well, I mean, well, let's go to the second part of your question first. So, okay. Of course, you potentially are missing out if your goal is to pursue different flavors and experience different things, and you don't choose to do that, then yes, you are missing out. You can easily find these coffees. They're at local roasteries. If you just go into your Google Maps and type in coffee roaster, it'll drop some pins nearby and go visit one of them. I'm sure they'll have a variety of offerings for you that would be very interesting. But to go to a sort of a more macroscopic point, the coffee that you like and the coffee I like can be different. And I hope they are, because it's an opportunity for you and I to have a wonderful conversation about the things that you enjoy and the things that I enjoy and why we like them. There's no objectively excellent coffee. What you might like and what I might like could be very different. You know, that acidic thing I just mentioned before may sound actually quite off-putting to you, and that's totally fine. However, it is very, very difficult to find a single coffee that exhibits all of the different flavors that I just mentioned. So, I mean, it's not like you go to one supplier of coffee and they're going to be able to provide you a floral forward coffee and also necessarily a marshmallowy graham crackery flavor profile coffee. They may have one, maybe not the other. You know, that's sort of the identity of the company.
Professor, I'm also wondering too, you know, are there some myths around coffee and caffeine that maybe we in the general population don't understand or maybe get wrong about coffee and caffeine from your perspective?
Well, there's the one that you face most regularly is the question of whether light roast or dark roast coffee contains more caffeine. What do you think the answer is? Do you think dark or light?
I would always say dark roast.
Yeah, so it's tricky, right? So we're going to get a little bit technical here, so bear with me for a second.
That's all right.
All right, so when you pick the coffee cherry off the plant, that cherry's the seed contained within the cherry is what the coffee bean is. At that moment in time, no more caffeine is going to be made by the plant. So the amount of caffeine contained within the seed at that moment is the highest it will ever be. Now, when you start roasting that coffee above a certain temperature, you start destroying caffeine. And most coffees are roasted above this temperature. So as a result, over time, the amount of caffeine contained within the bean is going to go, it's going to decrease with roast time. So the darker the roast, the less caffeine in each bean. So that might lead you to think that dark roast coffees have less caffeine in them. But it's not quite right, because as you lose caffeine, you're also losing other material as well. And that means that while the bean may have started out weighing, for example, 1 gram, as you roast darker and darker, the mass of the bean will decrease from 1 gram to, let's say, 0.85 of a gram. And so as a result, let's say you wanted to weigh out 2 grams of coffee, you would need to use more parts of a bean than you would if it was roasted lighter, because the lighter bean weighs more per bean. And so as a result, you use more beans to brew a dark roast coffee than you do for a light roast coffee if you're weighing the amount of coffee that you start with. Are you following along there?
I believe I am.
Okay. So with that in mind, it turns out that the tipping point, the rate at which you lose caffeine in the roaster, almost perfectly matches the rate of weight loss in the roaster. And so as a result, the amount of caffeine that is contained in a dark coffee drink and a light coffee drink are about the same, even though each bean of dark coffee contains less caffeine than it would have as a lighter roast counterpart.
Wow. Okay. That's, I think a myth was busted right there.
Complicated, I know. I'm sorry, but this is the level of fidelity we have to go to get to the bottom of these things.
Sure, sure. Here's perhaps more of a anthropological, botanical, even a philosophical question, but how has humanity changed coffee? And perhaps even more importantly, how has coffee changed humanity?
Oh, this is a good question. So I must admit, I am not necessarily the best person to provide an opinion on this. Actually, a colleague at the University of Oregon, Professor Diana Garvin, is in the Department of Romance Languages and has studied extensively this topic exactly. I'll do my best to summarize and basically say that the general idea in the emergence of coffee in Europe was like this idea you just basically drink a very quick small shot of espresso and carry on with your day, or perhaps maybe sit in the cafe and talk politics and propaganda and whatnot. Now, if you think of a cafe as being a community center and it brings people together, and at the time, sort of back in the 1950s, the cafe was also where politics were being discussed, I would say coffee has had a profound impact on society in that sense. Because if that's where people were sharing ideas and starting to understand one another's perspectives on the world, and it was all done over a small brown drink, then you can't really separate the small brown drink from the impact of the conversation that people were having, and vice versa. From a global economics perspective, coffee is extremely valuable and obviously matters a lot. So, for example, in the United States, the coffee industry contributes about 1.5% of U.S. GDP.
Wow.
In countries that, yeah, it's enormous. And in countries that produce coffee, for example, in Burundi, it's about 25% of the GDP for that country. But more importantly, about 90% of the working population is involved in one way or another in the coffee production side of things. So in the sense that, yeah, coffee is a global crop and it's consumed in basically every country, more importantly is this idea of keeping people employed and money moving around. And that really has an amplified effect in the producing countries.
Yeah. And almost along those lines, because many of us, and we've talked about this now for a while, you know, it gets us started in the morning. It keeps us going during the day. I mean, is coffee and caffeine, is it maybe, you know, the world's greatest performance enhancing drug?
Well, a lot of scientific literature has been published on that topic, basically looking at whether professional cyclists who have had caffeine or have not had it prior to entering a velodrome perform better. Long distance runners, another example of this. And the literature basically suggests that caffeine does enhance performance to a point. There's a limit, because you will also hear from time to time of some people, consuming caffeine and their heart failing because you basically overstimulated. And that obviously is not good. And so if you're a professional athlete and you're already pushing your heart to its limit, and then you also have this added effect, there's a risk. Now, that's obviously a risk that doesn't happen regularly. And I would say that most of us are not professional athletes. But the point is, it's definitely true that if you want to lift a heavier weight in your gym session tomorrow, or if you want to run an ever so slightly faster mile or whatever, coffee is going to help you do that to a point.
Okay. From your perspective, in your research and in your career, but also with colleagues as well, talk about the importance of coffee to science.
Yeah, this is actually an interesting one. So while I study coffee in my laboratory, I think coffee's impact in science is typically, I would say, other scientists going out with one another to a cafe to discuss scientific findings, funding opportunities, all of the things that we have to do to make scientific and technological progress. And as I mentioned earlier in a different answer to a different question, I mentioned that cafes are community centers that provoke conversation. That's been true in science and in other domains for as long as coffee has been served in cafes. And so in that regard, people joke that scientists drink a lot of coffee, and you probably imagine it's because we're in the lab and it's late at night and the round bottom flasks are bubbling away and we're trying to stay awake. But it's not really that. It's more that, you know, I have this idea and I need to go find an expert who knows this topic better than me to bounce an idea off of. And what better way to do it than to sit there and have a cup of coffee together?
Yeah, yeah. Professor, my last question for you is simply this. In researching you for this show, you know, I know you've talked about perhaps the holy grail, finding the perfect cup of coffee or the perfect espresso. You know, What might that look like? And have you found it?
Yeah, I think the reason that anyone gets into coffee in the first place is because we have this flavor experience that really draws us in and makes you think, wow, I never knew coffee could taste like that. I hope I get to taste a coffee that tastes like that again. And the unfortunate reality is that almost all of us never get that beautiful experience of that excellent coffee again. We're in constant pursuit of the next one that could maybe bring that flavor profile back into reality. And so in that regard, yeah, okay, I've probably had a coffee in my time that really makes me feel like this might be my perfect cup of coffee. The problem is that I've never had it again. And so that's why I study this scientifically, is why is it that I can't reproduce that experience when all of science is predicated on reproduction of an experiment? There should be no dependence on who performs the experiment or where it's performed. It should just be reproducible. And yet that is definitely not true in coffee. And so that's sort of the basis of what my laboratory studies. And I think that many of us have had that shared experience where we just wish that we could have that excellent cup of coffee in the morning every single time. And there's just inherent variability.
Indeed. But it's still so important to the morning. Christopher Hendon, associate professor in the Department of Chemistry and Biochemistry at the U of O, really appreciate you taking time with us. This has been fascinating.
Been my pleasure.
That's the show for today. All episodes of Oregon on the Record are available as a podcast at klcc.org. Monday on the show, you'll hear about one sector of the Oregon economy that's doing better than most: the growth and economic power of women's sports. I'm Michael Dunn, host of Oregon on the Record. Thanks for listening.